Tonight on PBS News Weekend, a new treatment for sickle cell disease using the revolutionary CRISPR gene editing technology now approved by the FDA. Then rising tensions in South America as Venezuela threatens to take over a large region of Guyana that's rich in resources. And on the eve of receiving the Nobel Prize for Economics for her work on women in the workforce, a conversation with Harvard professor Claudia Golden.
I have the sense that this isn't just my Nobel. It's a Nobel for women in general, and for that, I am very pleased.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. An unusual abortion rights case in Texas has taken a turn. The state Supreme Court temporarily blocked a lower court ruling that would have allowed a pregnant woman whose fetus has a fatal diagnosis to get an abortion despite some of the nation's most restrictive abortion laws. The one-page order stresses that it is not a ruling on the two sides' legal arguments and that the case remains undecided. Lawyers for Kate Cox, the 31-year-old mother of two in the case, say they fear that justice delayed for the at-risk pregnancy will be justice denied. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton asked for the pause, saying that an abortion while the case is pending could not be undone. Cox says she wants another child, but her doctors say carrying the fetus to term or inducing labor could risk serious complications, including infertility. Israel hit targets across the Gaza Strip today as its war with Hamas entered its third month. Israel ordered an evacuation of the central part of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says nearly 18,000 Palestinians have been killed since the start of the war. Israeli officials claim that 7,000 of them are militants. And at least 1,200 Israeli civilians and soldiers have been killed, most of them in the initial Hamas attack on October 7th. An Israeli hostage is reported to be among the dead. Hamas said 25-year-old Sahar Baruch was killed in a failed Israeli rescue mission. The Israeli military only says that two soldiers were seriously wounded in a rescue attempt that didn't free any hostages. On the final weekend of the United Nations COP28 climate conference, nations are clashing on long-standing disagreements over a global reduction in the use of fossil fuels. There are reports that the head of the powerful oil cartel OPEC urged its member nations to reject any language calling for a reduction of fossil fuels. And China, the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases, won't say whether it would agree to reductions in the use of oil, gas, or coal. The summit is to end on Tuesday. And ending weeks of speculation, two-way baseball superstar Shohei Ohtani says he's signing with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Reports say the 10-year deal is worth $700 million. That's a North American sports record. Ohtani, who excels both as a hitter and a pitcher, had spent the last six seasons with the Los Angeles Angels. Ohtani had elbow surgery in September, and doctors say he should be ready to go for next year's opening day. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, South American neighbors feud over an area rich in oil and gas. And Harvard professor Claudia Golden on her Nobel Prize-winning work studying women in the labor market.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
This week, the Food and Drug Administration approved a revolutionary treatment for sickle cell blood disease, a chronic, debilitating condition that affects nearly 100,000 Americans, most of them with African ancestry. It's caused by an inherited genetic mutation that distorts the shape of red blood cells. Yale Medical School Assistant Professor C.C. Calhoun specializes in caring for people with the disease.
When I talk to patients, especially my young adults who have sickle cell disease, they often tell me it's a silent disease. I feel unseen. People can't see what it is that I go through, what I'm trying to navigate. And so what this time represents is awareness and people seeing that sickle cell is real, starting to understand the way it affects people's ability to live life every day.
This is the first U.S.-approved medicine for a genetic disease that uses the groundbreaking gene editing tool called CRISPR. Gina Collada is a New York Times reporter who focuses on science and medicine. Gina, how big a deal is this, not just for the people who have sickle cell, but also for this technology, this gene editing technology?
It's actually a really big deal for both. For the people who have it, it offers them hope because there really wasn't much hope before this of a cure. Now, most people are probably not going to get it. It's expensive, it's onerous, not everybody is going to be eligible. But you can see sort of something on the horizon that maybe could make a difference, change your life. For CRISPR, it's also a huge deal because one of the questions with CRISPR is it safe? In this case, it's making a little cut in the DNA. And the issue is, how do you know it cut in the right place and that it didn't start cutting someplace else too? How do you know you aren't disrupting another gene that might cause cancer, for example? So what happened was the company Vertex and CRISPR Therapeutics that make this treatment, what they did was extensive tests saying, we are looking and looking to see if this treatment is disrupting other genes. So in both cases, it means a lot to have this treatment approved.
You say not all people with sickle cell would qualify for this. What's the difference? What would make someone ineligible for this?
What happens with sickle cell is the red blood cells get deformed and they get caught in blood vessels, and people have frequent episodes of really unbearable pain that send them to emergency rooms looking for opioids, and often they're dismissed as drug seeking. They get hospitalized. It's totally debilitating. In order to qualify, you have to have several of these episodes a year. And then the other thing that could make somebody ineligible is if their doctor thought they could not tolerate the grueling treatment. First, you have to have 8 weeks of transfusions when people are trying to take stem cells, immature cells, out of your bone marrow. You have to go to the hospital and spend a month there. First, they give you very intense chemotherapy to just totally wipe out your bone marrow, which is the source of your immune system, so that it's sort of cleaned out and ready for the gene-edited cells that they're going to put in. And then you have to wait for your bone marrow to grow back again. And so you're pretty much without an immune system for a month. And people who are frail, who've had a lot of other things go wrong with them, are not going to be able to tolerate it, at least in their doctor's opinion.
Now, the cause of sickle cell has been known for decades, but research seems to have languished over these years. Why do you think that is?
People attribute it to a couple of things. One of them is they knew what the cause was, but they didn't really know what to do about it. So that was made it really difficult to try to figure out, how do you treat this thing where you have one tiny change out of 3 billion DNA letters, one of them is changed and you have this awful disease. But another reason is there was not a lot of money poured into doing research on sickle cell. There's a thought that that had a lot to do with the population that was affected, mostly Black Americans, Hispanic Americans, many of them without much money. And they didn't have a strong advocacy group. People often compare it to cystic fibrosis, which strikes mostly white children, and it's about as common as sickle cell, but they had big fundraisers and telethons and lots of advocacy, and people knew about cystic fibrosis, and money poured in, and there was a lot more research on cystic fibrosis than there was on sickle cell. So I think that one reason it languished was simply that people kind of didn't care enough.
Gina Collado, The New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Tensions between South American neighbors Venezuela and Guyana escalated this week over a century-old territorial dispute. Today, Venezuela signaled openness to high-level talks to resolve the standoff, but Guyana has yet to respond. Ali Rogan has more.
Last week, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro held a referendum to declare sovereignty over a resource-rich region that makes up two-thirds of Guyana's territory. Maduro pledged to begin oil and mining exploration immediately.
Let's see where on the map we will celebrate tonight. Long live the complete map of Venezuela. Long live the homeland. Long live all of Venezuela.
Both countries have claimed ownership of the Essequibo region since its borders were decided in favor of Guyana over a century ago when Guyana was still a British colony. But the discovery in recent years of 11 billion barrels worth of oil and gas off Guyana's coast gave new life to the dispute. New oil drilling is driving huge gains in Guyana's economy as Venezuela's economy flounders despite its own massive reserves. Carolina Jimenez Sandoval is president of the Washington Office on Latin America, a research organization that advocates for human rights in Latin America. Carolina, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit more about the importance that Essequibo has played in recent years and decades in terms of the culture of both of these countries?
I think for Venezuela, this is an old century issue. Most Venezuelans grew up believing strongly, reinforcing the idea that the Essequibo is part of Venezuela, but that it is a territory in dispute. As children, in school books, people used to draw the Essequibo region with dotted lines saying, you know, territory to be claimed. For Guyana, it's territory. I mean, it comprises two-thirds of the current Guyana's as a country territory. So I think it is indeed, a very complex country when you have a country that lives there, that occupies the territory effectively, and another one claiming its historical rights to the land.
And why is Maduro taking these steps at this time?
I think there are two things that are important to understand when one sees the current conflict. One is oil. That's a huge reserve, and it's a very important, as we know, product for the world, even today. But the second, and I think it's really important to think about this, is internal Venezuelan politics. Maduro is a deeply unpopular leader, and he's also deeply authoritarian, and he faces presidential elections in 2024. At the end of October, the opposition, for the first time in years, self-organized primary elections to choose one candidate who could run against Maduro in 2024. It seems the Maduro government underestimated this citizen exercise because it was self-managed. The National Electoral Authority didn't play any role. Over 2.3 million people voted, including people in different cities around the world because the diaspora had a chance to participate. And the support went overwhelmingly to one candidate, Maria Corina Machado. The government seems to have been taken by surprise. As a result, we see a tremendous propaganda apparatus set in place to then change the narrative and take all the attention away from that issue and make everyone speak about a territorial dispute that is over a century years old.
And how is this playing out with the average Venezuelan? What are they thinking of this, and how do they view Nicolas Maduro in this context?
When you look at the referendum itself, what you notice is that although Maduro claimed that 10.4 million people went to vote, independent media and citizens themselves reported a very low turnout. So I think his lack of popularity really shows around this, and I think Venezuela wants a peaceful transition to democracy because it's, you know, for many years, human rights violations have been at the forefront of his leadership.
How is Guyana responding?
For Guyana, this is an existential threat, right? I mean, Maduro is claiming, you know, two-thirds of their territory. And I think the president of Guyana has been, very clear about, first of all, defending, you know, their country, but they have also, I mean, the government has also been very strategic at rallying support from its allies. The U.S. government has very clearly said that it supports Guyana. I think the Guyanese government has also gone to the U.N. Security Council, has, you know, tried to rally support among Caribbean countries. So it seems that the strategy is to get as much international support as possible to avoid an escalation of the crisis.
And how big is the risk of escalation here? There have been troop movements that have taken place as a result, but what is the possibility that this turns into some sort of a confrontation?
Maduro's nationalistic rhetoric seems to, promote the idea that the government is willing to go to the very end, whatever the consequences, to reclaim this territory. But the reality is that Maduro's allies will not support, you know, any further escalation of the conflict. And I don't think, you know, any leader in the region or even the U.S. wants another war in the world, and certainly a war in South America. So despite its loud narrative about going all the way, I think there will be a lot of international resistance.
And in terms of the United States' response, they've come out squarely behind Guyana, but at the same time, the United States lifted sanctions, oil sanctions on Venezuela earlier this year in exchange for some electoral concessions in the upcoming election, allowing opposition candidates to stand. At least that was the agreement, if not in practice. How does this affect that situation with the United States?
I think Maduro keeps putting the U.S. government to a major dilemma, to continue supporting negotiations between the democratic opposition and the government, to continue supporting the agreement signed in Barbados, and at the same time, you know, to react to Maduro's actions around the Essequibo and to demand that it fulfills agreements, because so far the U.S. indeed lifted sanctions, but Maduro hasn't done, you know, his part. He hasn't released political prisoners that are Americans or other political prisoners. He still hasn't given proper electoral guarantees for the elections in 2024. But I think the best thing the U.S. can do is to continue supporting the negotiation process between the opposition and the Maduro government, supporting human rights and, you know, for Venezuelans inside the country and outside the country, and to oppose any further escalation of this crisis.
Carolina Jimenez Sandoval with the Washington Office on Latin America, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
At a time-honored ceremony in Stockholm, Sweden tomorrow, the King of Sweden is to hand medals to this year's Nobel laureates. Among them will be Claudia Golden, recipient of the prize in economics, for her research on women in the American workforce. She's only the third woman to get that honor and the first to win it solo, not sharing it with anybody else. Economics correspondent Paul Solomon spoke with her about her trailblazing work.
Where did you grow up?
The Bronx, New York City.
Were you at all interested in economics? You went to the Bronx High School of Science, right?
I didn't know what economics was. Most high school students don't know what economics is. That's good. That's fine. There are many things that you should learn when you're more mature.
Golden's Nobel Prize is for her work on the economics of women, and in particular, the increasing role of women in the workplace.
It happened that a woman's delicate touch enabled her even to excel men in certain precision operations.
One against-the-grain finding, that Rosie the Riveter was not a main driver. Golden posed a question.
You know, if World War II had not existed, what would labor force participation of women have been in 1950? It probably would have been a little bit lower, but not much. The treatment effect of the war was probably felt most by the more educated women who had had the clerical jobs during World War II, not the ones who, like Rosie, would have been in the factories.
The most accurate image of Rosie, says Golden, is Norman Rockwell's, a temporary wartime factory worker whose job was to crush Hitler underfoot, not the now more famous image.
But that's the one that's become so popular.
That's right, because she's cute.
Well, she's tough.
She's also very pretty. She was like 17, 18 years old. Norman Rockwell Rosie is the real Rosie.
A Rosie who often returned to housework when the soldiers came home from the war, reclaiming the factory work. But other women kept joining the workforce. One reason? The birth control pill, Golden says. Easier access to the pill in the 1970s helped more women pursue life outside the home.
It gave to women who were graduating from college the ability to have more time to form their careers either in the workplace or by going to professional or graduate school. It causally led to an increase in the age at first marriage. And that meant that one could concentrate more on careers and have the family later.
Which leads to today, with more than 77% of women in the workforce, up from 28% in 1940. And yet, the gender wage gap hasn't closed all that much. Women earn 82 cents for every man's dollar. Some 20 years ago, they earned 80 cents on the dollar.
When men and women begin their lives as workers, they earn similar amounts. And as their lives progress, these differences widen. I mean, that's a fact. And then the question is, how do we explain it?
And what did you find?
Much of this occurs around the time of the birth of a child. That explains a large part of the widening gap between men and women as men and women get older. What women, particularly those who are mothers, lose relative to men who are fathers is not fully made up. And if anything, men who are fathers, we see, seem to have something that we call the paternal premium.
Mom and dad are equally educated, equally able, working what Golden calls greedy jobs, 100-hour weeks and sky-high pay. But then
they just had a child, they want a second one, and they realize this is untenable, that someone has to be the on-call at-home parent.
So mom stays home, dad stays in the pressure cooker. But fathers not only work more hours and thus make more money than mothers, they also make more than single men.
Why?
There are several possibilities, but the one that seems most believable is they somehow internally decide that they should rev up their energies to earn more, provide for the growing group of children.
That was the story until the pandemic, which may now cause the pay gap to narrow.
About 30% of days worked are now at home, are now remote. Greedy jobs have gotten more flexible, and flexible jobs have gotten more productive. We have learned to work better. We have learned, too, that working remotely can be done productively.
Which means women are more able to do greedy jobs, too. Moreover,
women are getting more graduate and even postgraduate degrees, and that difference is increasing, right? We still need to worry about a gender gap.
The differences in earnings at the upper end of the education and occupation distribution, the gender gap is much, much larger than for individuals who have less education, whose jobs are not in the professional category. So it's enormously high.
I read something that said 5 years from now, women will be getting double the number of college degrees as men. So won't that mean that women are taking more and more high positions in the economy, even though women might still be expected to take care of the kids more than men are?
We would have to see, first of all, who's marrying whom and what degrees they have and what jobs they're going into. But to the extent that higher education means that the more doors are open to you, yeah, that certainly could narrow the gap.
I had one last question.
What's your reaction to getting the Nobel Prize in economics?
It has not yet sunk in, other than the fact that I got 1,600 emails in 36 hours that I had to go through, and it caused a certain amount of eye strain. I am delighted. And the 1,600 emails included hundreds and hundreds of emails that said, I cried, I want to hug you. And I have the sense that this isn't just my Nobel. It's a Nobel for women in general. And for that, I am very pleased.
As are many of us. For PBS News Weekend, Paul Solman.
Before we go, we want to let you know that Liz McGill says she is resigning as president of the University of Pennsylvania. She's been under fire after seeming evasive when asked at a congressional hearing this week if Penn would discipline students if they called for the genocide of Jewish people. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.